and this is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song, and Jesse Hoffnung-Garskoff, his last name is spelled Hoffnung-Garskoff, teaches history and American culture at the University of Michigan. We've put links on againstthegrain.org to his faculty page at Michigan, to his book A Tale of Two Cities, Santo Domingo and New York After 1950, and to the Afro-Latina Latino Reader, History and Culture in the United States, to which Jesse has contributed an article about Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, and more generally, and perhaps in my mind, more importantly, having read this essay, about the broader political and racial environment of New York City in the late 1800s and 1900s, and how Schomburg interacted with that environment and what he was able to accomplish. You mentioned the kind of, I don't know, I guess you could call it the rhetoric of the Cuban Revolutionary Party and the extent to which it was advocating for racial equality and the extent to which that was kind of unusual among political groupings in that time and maybe even in our time. To what extent did the Cuban Revolutionary Party, though, actually incorporate people of color and working class people into its activities?
It did to a really dramatic extent, and it's sometimes hard to discover it, because one of the things that happens when you have a race-blind nationalism is that people are encouraged not to identify themselves in public places by race. And by the same token, people are encouraged not to identify others. So, for instance, Schomburg and his colleagues were very sharp in their criticism of white allies who identified them as black Cubans. They said, wait a second, the idea is we're all Cubans. We shouldn't come with a hyphen, right? We're just as much Cuban as you are, and you shouldn't call us, you know, Schomburg was Puerto Rican, but his allies who were Cuban, you shouldn't do that. So that means that in the public registries, you know, looking at lists of who was in the movement, you can't tell just from the name whether someone's was white or black. But through a number of ways, I've been able to identify, in fact, that people were themselves identifying as black and that others were identifying them as black or as at least partially descended from Africans. One of the ways to do this was by checking party lists against the U.S. Census. Of course, that only tells you what a U.S. Census taker thought a person was, but it's still a pretty good guess that if you look at a list of, say, the political club that Schomburg was in, that the leadership of that club, all of the elected officials in that club, were men who were identified on the U.S. Census as black or mulatto. And the other thing that I've been able to do is to look at the writings of some of the key figures who did themselves identify as black. And in those writings, I've been able to tell that there existed a kind of a network, not just the Masonic Lodge, but a whole network of organizations founded by key black intellectuals. Many of them, like Schomburg, were from an artisan background, but had become intellectuals, journalists, political activists in a number of ways, that they created a whole group of organizations. And as I look at the membership of those organizations, I can see that there really was a community of people of African descent who were both in the formal movement, the Cuban Revolutionary Party, and in all of these ancillary social and political and educational clubs, which seem, as I suggested before, seem to be their kind of support basis. They have clubs that are organized by them for themselves as men of color, and in some instances women of color too, but for the most part these clubs were for men of color. And then they also engage and join in the Cuban Revolutionary Party, usually through the vehicle of working class clubs. Most of the party had a very small leadership, and most of the party base was made up of individual clubs created by individual working class collectivities. And among those were some clubs that were mostly white working class, some clubs that were very clearly mixed, and subclubs that were, seemed to me, at least from what I've been able to tell, were founded by men of color and mostly populated by men of color. And the club that Schomburg joined was one of those. I actually think, interestingly enough, the one that Schomburg joined was one of the rare clubs that was founded by men of color, led by men of color, but actually included in the rank and file a number of working class white men as well. So it was a multiracial club with a black leadership, which is really, again, something fairly unique in the Atlantic world at this time. A political club that has a multiracial base, but not a political club with a multiracial base that nevertheless has a white leadership, as you kind of suspect in these kind of situations. But actually a place where white working class men, you know, in some ways live up to their ideal of equality by allowing and supporting a leadership that is racially other to them.
I think the political club you're referring to, which was part of the Cuban Revolutionary Party, was Las Dos Antillas. What were the mission and goals of that club? And maybe then, and maybe this leads to the answer that might be lingering in some listeners' minds, which is why would a Puerto Rican get so involved in Cuban independence struggles?
Right, right. Yeah, that's a great question. So the goals of, I mean, it's called Las Dos Antillas, and for those of those listeners who don't speak Spanish, that means the two Antilles. And of course, there are more than two Antilles, but in this moment, what they're talking about are the two Caribbean islands, Puerto Rico and Cuba. And actually, those two islands were the two remaining Caribbean colonies of Spain. So they were in a similar political situation, and it had been since 1868, at least, if not before, that the relatively smaller group of Puerto Ricans who were interested in autonomy from or independence from Spain had been very intensely connected and allied with Cubans with the same project. They lived under the same colonial aegis, they were close to each other, and they had very much overlapping goals. And, you know, they both, the leaders from Puerto Rico and the leaders from Cuba who were seeking to renegotiate their colonial status, were both passing through the same, you know, metropolitan capital, Madrid. So they knew each other in Madrid, and they shared publications. So that's the basic outline. The Puerto Rican movement was never as strong. They didn't have the 10 Years' War. They didn't have a rebellion in the 1890s. And so very frequently, they were in a position, as part of their Puerto Rican independence or Puerto Rican autonomy struggles, to be partners with Cubans in struggles that in some ways were flaring up, or their most promising on the Cuban side of the equation. You can see that happening among Puerto Ricans, the few Puerto Ricans that are in New York since the 1860s. Now, for Schomburg and his contemporaries, my argument has been for a long time that race was a compounding factor of that, right? That when they saw themselves as Antillians and they saw their alliance with the Cubans, for the working class men and to a lesser extent women from Puerto Rico who made their way to New York to join this movement, one of the big attractions was the prominence of Afro-Cubans and Afro-Cuban concerns in the movement itself, right? These are men who had been negotiating their tenuous position within the liberal movement on the island of Puerto Rico. In the late 1880s, they have some serious differences with the white liberal leadership. And as a result, many of them move to New York and very quickly join the Cuban struggle. And in that process, they tend to take a more radical stance towards independence. So the club itself, Las Dos Antillas, therefore, is a club that's actually founded by Puerto Ricans with the express intent of having one club that will have both Puerto Ricans and Cubans together in a shared struggle for independence and Republican rule on the two islands. And that's their basic lemma, right? We are fighting for the independence of the two islands. That's what they kind of publish. But if you read the fine print, and I actually was fortunate enough to read the meeting minutes of this political club, it was a secret political club that was undertaking seditious activity as far as the Spanish crown was concerned. You know, independence activism was sedition. So they kept the secret, but the person who kept the logbooks happened to be Schomburg. He was the recording secretary of this club. And so his wonderful collection of papers at the Schomburg Center for the Study of Black Culture, his notebook, the minute book from this club, is there, and I was able to read those minutes. And as you read down, you realize, yeah, they're interested in independence. They're trying to raise funds to buy weapons. They want to join expeditions and go and fight because they see their manhood is tied up with vigorous military action against what they think of as the kind of the injury and insult of colonialism. But if you keep reading down, you see that they're also really interested in creating a republic that, to their minds, will live up to fully liberal ideas about the equality of all men, and particularly they want what they identify as kind of colonial vices, including caste and class prejudice, to be abolished by a new republican order. And they're aware, very clearly aware, that some of their liberal allies would be very happy to create a new republican order which preserved caste and class prejudices. And for this reason, I think that they really value, those Puerto Rican men really value the particular connection that they have in these working class mixed race clubs with working class Cubans and Cubans of color who share their struggle for equality within independence.
You write that Schomburg made a dramatic transition from nationalist politics, which saw possibilities for racial advancement through the Cuban and Puerto Rican struggle, to an explicitly racial politics. Tell us more about that.
Right. So the nationalist politics is what we've been talking about. It's Martí's vision that Cuba and then extended to Puerto Rico will be places where, on the one hand, racism is abolished, right? So white racists will have to abandon their privilege, according to this theory. But on the other hand, race will be abolished, so in the sense that independent black organizations will have to give up, in some ways, their right to speak as anything but members of the broader community. And in fact, there are Cubans after independence who are accused, black Cubans who are accused of racism for doing exactly that. So that's the one kind of politics, a kind of cross-racial nationalist alliances, which have great benefits and attractions, but also have the downside. After 1898, when the Puerto Rican and Cuban revolutionary activists in New York, many of them ended up quite disillusioned, especially the Puerto Ricans, right? Because independence doesn't come for Puerto Rico in 1888. Puerto Rico merely shifts from being a Spanish colony to being a U.S. colony. And in that process, the promise of radical equality along class and racial lines doesn't come to fruition. And in the same way, although the Cuban Republic that's founded in 1901 is quite dramatic in offering full manhood suffrage, regardless of race, so full manhood suffrage and full citizenship to men of color, which is a great victory for this movement, it's nevertheless, it is a republic that preserves many, as we know, places don't change that quickly, and many of the prerogatives of race and the kind of discriminations and inequalities of race are preserved there. So Schomburg was really disappointed in both the outcome in Puerto Rico and the outcome in Cuba, and at the same time, he was increasingly attracted by some alternative kinds of politics which seemed to, at the moment, to him, to promise more in the way of racial advancement and equality. And those were movements, Pan-Africanist movements, which were important among both African Americans and also West Indian immigrants in New York at the time, and also which connected him with some activists in Puerto Rico and Cuba, as well as some in Liberia. This was a view in which white allies in nationalist contexts were not to be trusted. They would eventually always kind of renege on whatever promises they made, and that the real strength would come through unity across national and ethnic lines among people of African descent. This is really one of the early kind of formal politics based on the idea of diaspora. And in fact, Schomburg writes in 1911 a speech in which he argues very clearly that black people should follow the example of the Jews. As far as he saw it, and I'm Jewish, and I know that some of my ancestors would argue with this, but as far as he saw it, Jews, no matter where they live, they always maintain their primary identity as Jews and their connection to Jews in other places. And this helped them resist the hatred that they experienced among the nations that they lived. And he thought the sons of Africa, the children of Africa, should do the same thing. Rather than being divided by linguistic differences or being divided across national lines, they should forge an international racial unity, or what he called racial integrity, that would then serve as a kind of a key power base for claiming full rights in the individual places that they lived, as well as for correcting some of what he saw as the kind of alienating properties of Western civilization. He particularly became focused on the question of history, and he thought that if he could be become the historian who collected the historical documents that showed the links between the different parts of the African diaspora, that might become the basis for political unity that would be very powerful. So this is what I mean in terms of his radical transformation. He goes from being someone who's really committed to multiracial activism, both at a class level and at a nationalist level, which places the unity and the cordiality among races really at the center of a project of racial equality, right? That the idea is we're going to do better if what we do is create nations which formally acknowledge our equality and work within the kind of race-blind structures as strategies for trying to create racial advancement. He gives that up. For the most part, he gives that up, and he joins this other model which says, no, we should not get into cross-racial alliances. What we should do is build an alliance only among people of color, and what we should do is kind of abandon our nationalist frameworks and join together across national boundaries to find strength in our racial unity. And I would say, you know, obviously both formulations have their advantages and drawbacks, which he discovers.
Jesse Hoffman-Garskoff is Associate Professor of History and American Culture at the University of Michigan, and he's written about the world of Arturo Alfonso Schomburg in a couple places, actually, where I found an essay of his in the new volume, The Afro-Latina Latino Reader. We have links on againstthegrain.org.
So the first essay that I wrote about Schomburg actually came out in 2001, and it really focused on the idea of Schomburg as a kind of a unique exception to what we saw as a broad pattern of Puerto Rican and Afro-Latino experience in the United States. That the idea was that Afro-Puerto Ricans and Afro-Latinos in general tried to really attach themselves to Latino communities and to avoid contact with African Americans as a way of both of expressing their own racial identities as they brought with them from the island, but also as a way of avoiding the negative social consequences of being identified as black in the United States. I mean, this is certainly a context where you could understand that. One wouldn't want to voluntarily walk into the maw of segregation. So the first essay really tried to make sense of Schomburg's exceptionalism within that framework. But in the process of writing that essay and trying to understand how Schomburg himself moved from one kind of politics and one kind of social situation to another, I started to find hints that, in fact, he wasn't all that unusual after all. And so the essay that's more recently come out in the Afro-Latino Reader, rather than being primarily about Schomburg, the first essay was called The Migrations of Arturo Schomburg. It's about Schomburg's own transformations. This is about the world of Arturo Schomburg, and it's really about trying to connect the dots and find all of the other people who in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century were more similar to Schomburg than in fact different. And so it's really about situating him in a number of social contexts, political worlds, social worlds, residential patterns that actually make a lot more sense of him, not as an exception, but as somebody who actually is representative of the world from which he came.
To what extent did Schomburg's mission become one of confronting the arguments made by the race science, quote, science of the day, the arguments being advanced for the inferiority of non-whites, and related to this, his activities as a collector of books and historical documents, to what extent were his collecting activities related to perhaps that mission?
They were directly related. As I just mentioned, his political project was one of racial unity across national boundaries. And his collecting project really was a part of that political project. I mean, he was also an intellectual, and all intellectuals have both our you know, what drives us politically, but also, you know, our own peculiarities. And he clearly had fascination with historical documents on their own terms. But his expressed reason for collecting was that he saw the mainstream history of the time, and he was really right in his critique of it, the mainstream history of his time, he saw it as debilitating to black political mobilization. He understood that most nationalist histories, and most histories at this time were nationalist, downplayed the capacity for non-white peoples to really even have a history or participate in history. And since history was really imagined at the time as the basis for national greatness, and this was really the way that the German historical profession and then the U.S. historical profession and other places imagined history, that history was about the coming to fruition of a nation. And so it was about looking to the national past and explaining national character and national greatness by looking at the contribution of the national stock, really imagined as racial stock, to world civilization, right? I can give you an example of a person in you know, a mainstream historian of the time who saw things this way was Theodore Roosevelt, who happened also to be a major military figure in the war in 1898, as well as then a president in Schomburg's lifetime. And he made the argument that really the history of the United States was the history of the Anglo-Saxon people. And it was the history of the Anglo-Saxon people in their conflicts with non-white people in one context or another, and that those conflicts created a kind of a virile, manly national identity, which was the explanation for the greatness of the American national project. So Schomburg rightly identified, first of all, that blacks were missing from this project. And if you go back and you look at Roosevelt's writings, for instance, I mean, Schomburg wasn't criticizing Roosevelt in particular, but if you just take him as an example, it's true. I mean, Roosevelt even writes Indians, you know, Native Americans in, he writes them in as adversaries, but he very clearly leaves out African Americans, even the African Americans who were fighting alongside him in Cuba and in when he was down there. So that African Americans are left out, and in a world in which these ideas of history and historical greatness are being used to explain which countries get to have, you know, modern polities and which ones don't, he saw that this basically wasn't a disempowering move, right? That the idea that blacks were erased from history or that their role in history was diminished to role roles as kind of uncivilized barbarians was essential to the colonial projects and to the racist projects within nation states, which denied blacks full citizenship or the right to self-govern. So that he identified that from a political perspective, but he also identified, and this is, I think in this sense he was really very modern, and I think was reflecting on his own experience as someone who had been born in a colony and then had spent the first part of his life in a colony, the second part of his life fighting against colonialism, and then the third part of his life being really a racial activist within the United States, that he was very aware of the psychological effect that being written out of history could have on students, on black students or black people. And he was aware also, when he was a Puerto Rican activist, of how this, what the effect that this had on Puerto Ricans, that he saw that this is as essentially alienating, and it made people feel disentangled from history and disconnected from their own past in a way that he felt was disempowering and would undermine the project of racial unity. So he really saw his collecting project both as a kind of a direct contradiction to the racial theories of leading historians, people like Roosevelt and others, but he also saw it as a kind of a self-actualization project, as a project that would be a resource for black students, black teachers, and black activists who could then have access to the history that proved that they were active participants in the march of civilization, and that that could then be a basis for their future actions.
In 1926, Schomburg sold his collection to the New York Public Library. It was later named the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. He became the center's curator until he died in 1938. And Schomburg, fascinating figure, and really kind of fascinating what was happening in New York City in the late 1800s, early 1900s, around nationalist causes, racialist causes. What relevance do you think Schomburg's activities have for today? What lessons can we learn from what he did and the milieu in which he was active?
Yeah, well, your first question, I think, kind of leads us in this direction, because you asked, the first question was, how many Puerto Ricans were here when Schomburg arrived? And the answer is very, very few. And so we have to recognize first that the world that Schomburg lived in, as much as it shows us about the kind of his own path through politics and social organization of the 1890s and the early 20th century, we have to be somewhat skeptical about how much it will tell us, say, about the 1950s, when there are millions of Puerto Ricans in New York, and the experience of Afro-Puerto Ricans clearly is somewhat different. But I do think, nevertheless, that there are clear lessons to be drawn. I mean, the first is our initial historical attempt to try and understand the Puerto Rican racial experience in New York, in which we understand that, on the one hand, Puerto Ricans are racialized as Latinos as a whole group, that even white people from Puerto Rico oftentimes are considered to be non-whites in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they also have racial divisions among themselves that they practice among themselves, as well as somewhat different experiences depending on how they're perceived by the receiving society. That's all so clearly visible in Schomburg's story, right? He's able to simultaneously show us how the advantages and disadvantages of alliance with his co-ethnics, with other Puerto Ricans, either as a national cause or, once it's no longer national, but a much more of an ethnic kind of a cause, that offers Puerto Ricans of African descent and Latinos of African descent certain kinds of advantages, but doesn't necessarily negate the possibility that they will simultaneously also experience very different kinds of reception from the receiving society, and may find all kinds of advantages and opportunities in alliances that they construct along racial lines. And my suspicion is, as much as the world changes between Schomburg's, the period that Schomburg was in and the period that we're in, you know, we see in the later 20th century, that really remains a constant. It's always possible for people to maintain that kind of dual vision of their belonging and to experience, you know, racism and also possibilities of racial inclusion in multiple contexts at the same time, both within their communities as Puerto Ricans, but also across communities or within their communities that they define with other people of African descent.
Jesse Hoffnung-Garskoff, University of Michigan Professor of History and American Culture, links on againstthegrain.org to his book, A Tale of Two Cities, and to the Afro-Latina Latino Reader, in which you can read an essay Jesse wrote that has been the focus of our discussion today. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great fun.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time.